some of you were over in Koinonia last hour, and we're shifting places and shifting gears and going into something quite different, but something which is also very much related. And so there will be continuities and discontinuities. And what we're going to do here, we have slightly over an hour, is that I'm going to try to define, to describe, to get at the phrase lifeboat ethics, which is a phrase that's being used a great deal these days. And John then is going to relate that. Lifeboat ethics has to do really with global economics. John is going to take that same notion and relate it to questions about individuals, who shall survive, and has a film that is 25 minutes. And so we have some talk, we have some film, and then we'll have some conversation. And that's what's going to happen while we're together. Let me try to get at that lifeboat ethics thing a little bit indirectly at first, but then head on with the person who formulated the title. I'm reading now from the Hastings Center Report, an article by Daniel Callahan, who comments on lifeboat ethics, and he refers to some people. Dr. Jay Forrester, whose work had to do with the Club of Rome's study on the limits to growth. Most of you know about that. There's a second study out now from the report to the Club of Rome. Was reported to have said that the time may have come to adopt an ethic of triage with respect to poor countries by providing aid only to those countries which have the best chance of survival. Okay? Triage is a French word. It has to do with battlefield decisions, and it has to do with three categories of casualties. Category one is those people who can be repaired on the battlefield with some kind of drugs or band-aids or whatever, and sent immediately back into battle. Category two is those people who are repairable, but whose repair will take more time than can be taken on the battlefield, and they have to be sent back of the lines into a hospital and fixed up and then back into battle. Category three is of those people who cannot be repaired either on the battlefield or in the hospital and therefore have to be abandoned because they are of no use to the cause. So there are three categories of people. That's called triage. And Jay Forrester and many other people are saying that we're in that kind of a situation globally. There are, all of us have problems. Let's say the United States needs some band-aids, maybe some pretty big band-aids, but is at least theoretically repairable. There are also poor countries, third world countries, that with massive input of economic and other kinds of aid, technical assistance, etc., can make it. But there is a category C, these people are saying, of nation, which are irreparable, and that the only sane and the only helpful thing to do is to abandon them. Okay? That's the application of triage, and that's Jay Forrester. Dr. Philip Handler, president of the National Academy of Sciences, in a recent speech on the state of man, notes that the population growth in poor countries is much greater than that in rich countries, and that this is particularly the case in South Asia, it may simply happen, he observes, that the developed countries of the world will have to decide to forget those countries, to give them up as hopeless. That's a hard decision to make, but the president of the National Academy of Sciences is suggesting that as a possibility. Paul Ehrlich in The Population Bomb, The Paddock Brothers, and Famine 1975. Some of you know those books have suggested the same thing a long time ago. When that kind of talk first began, it was looked upon as absolutely outrageous by all kinds of people. The new thing that has happened is that that same kind of thinking has become legitimized and widely discussed by vast numbers of people. And one of the most articulate spokesmen for the position is Garrett Hardin of the University of California at Santa Barbara, who is a professor of ecology there. And he is the one who has formulated the term lifeboat ethics. And he has written articles under this theme in Commentary, in Psychology Today, in any number of other journals, and there are all kinds of people commenting on that, and it's a major discussion going on in our time, lifeboat ethics. What I want to do in the next few minutes is simply to describe the position. Okay? Hardin says that it is impossible to think without metaphors. That is, images are necessary. We're stuck with images. We can't think without them. And so when he talks about lifeboat ethics, he wants to do away immediately with the argument, well, that's just a metaphor. That's just an analogy. Yes, of course it's a metaphor. We have no choice but to think in metaphors. The question is the metaphor apt? Is the metaphor useful? And he begins by saying that Kenneth Boulding, University of Colorado, professor of economics, provided for us for a time a new metaphor talking about spaceship Earth. And that Boulding said that we have to give up the old cowboy economics, which thought in terms of unlimited resources. It says it isn't like that. The Earth is like a spaceship whirling through space with limited resources, and on which everything somehow or another has to be accounted for. The astronauts have to worry about not only food, but they have to worry about garbage. Huh? Everything is contained in that spaceship, and that's the way the Earth is. And that's a whole new metaphor. It's a whole new way of thinking. It is a way of destroying what Boulding calls cowboy ethics and cowboy economics, and starting to think in terms of a limited, finite space, limited, finite number of resources with which we have to do. Now, Hardin says, that's an interesting metaphor, and it's useful particularly to help us with problems of pollution. We don't worry too much about pollution with cowboy economics, but if we think of ourselves as a spaceship, then we had better worry about pollution on that spaceship. So it's helpful. But Hardin says that that spaceship economics and spaceship ethics is suicidal. And so he says we've got to think in some other terms. We've got to think in terms of life on a lifeboat, living on a lifeboat, and that's different from a spaceship. Hardin says that one third of the world, I think these figures most of us would simply agree to, one third of the people in this world are rich, and two-thirds are poor. Now, there are all kinds of gradations, but the differences are really massive. He says that the gross national product of the two-thirds is $200 per year per person, and the gross national product of the one-third is about $3,000, in the United States about five. So the difference is radical between the rich and the poor. And Hardin says that the rich nations are living on a lifeboat, and the poor nations are also living on a lifeboat, and they're living on much more crowded lifeboats. So then he says, let's say that the capacity of a lifeboat is 50. And that there's a safety factor of 10. You can load on 10 more, but that's all. And that's a safety factor because you can carry 60 in the lifeboat if all the conditions are perfect. But if you get a big storm, big waves, 60 is too many. You can only carry 50 safely. So here we are, Americans, let's say, rich nation. And we're in a lifeboat, and we've got 50 in the lifeboat. And there are other lifeboats around us with 100 each. Capacity, top capacity, 60. 100 each in the lifeboat. And out of those other lifeboats, people are constantly falling and shoving one another and falling into the river, and they swim around and they come up to our lifeboat and they want to get on. So Hardin says, what do we do with that? How do we act? How do we behave? He says there are at least three possibilities. The first is that if we follow Christian or Marxist ethics, Hardin is against both. If we follow Christian or Marxist ethics, Marxist ethics being from each according to his abilities to each according to his needs. If we follow either Christian or Marxist ethics, then we simply haul them all on board and all go down. Beautiful, but at suicide, if you know what you're doing and you want to do that, okay, but to simply haul everybody on board is to sink the boat. Okay. A second thing that can be done is to take on 10, up to the safety factor. Hardin says, for one thing, you're going to lose your safety factor, and a storm is going to come, and you're going to go down. For a second thing, how do you decide which 10? Is this 100 people floating around? How do you choose to do that? Another possibility is for a person to say, gee, I'm in a lifeboat with 50, and I had nothing to do with that. I happened to be born rich, in a rich country, and I feel very guilty about that, and so I'll jump in and give someone else my place. Hardin says, that's nice. And if you want to do that, okay. But what you're going to do is get someone else on the boat who's going to feel guilty. I'm going to jump out and get someone else. And then eventually, you're going to have 50 people who feel no guilt at all. So what you've managed to do is to exchange 50 people who have some, guilt and sensitivity toward it with 50 who can, you know, just kick everybody in the face and keep it. So has that accomplished very much? So he rejects all of those and comes out with an essentially triage notion. He says, hard as that is, it's the only way to go. And so he fleshes that out with a lot of statistics about reproduction and a lot of theory. He talks about the tragedy of the commons, where he says if you have a grazing land, for instance, that doesn't belong to anybody, calls that the commons, what you have is overgrazing. He says that voluntary restraints are absolutely worthless because they are wrecked as soon as you have an exception of one. All it takes is one person bring his cattle in there and wreck the grazing lands. I don't know very much about the topography and geography and the ecology of the Sahel, but I've read stuff, and you have too, about the overgrazing of that land, which has all kinds of implications for rainfall. And part of the problem is that you have vast amounts of land that belong to everybody and therefore belong to no one. So Hardin says that we have to begin to talk about responsibilities as well as rights. And he goes after the World Food Bank, for instance. He says that's not a bank at all. That's just a way of hauling people onto the lifeboat. That's just a way of transferring food from the rich to the poor. That's not a bank. And as long as you have rights, inalienable rights, without responsibilities, so that you have increase in the birth rate, and anybody who wants can go get out of the bank, he says what you've got is an overload on the lifeboat. Well, that's a detailed argument. All I'm trying to do is to introduce that. What it amounts to, what it comes down to, is a question of survival, but it also has something to do with the question of life as an absolute right, or life in terms of quality. And Hardin, over and over again, talks about the quality of life. That is, we must keep 50 in the lifeboat to survive, but not only to survive. We must keep 50 in the lifeboat to maintain a certain quality of life. And he would say that that's also true for the poor nations. Well, when you begin to talk about quality of life, then you move from global economics down to ethics and ethical decisions toward individuals, and it's just a hop and a skip and a jump to the point where one says those poor nations ought not to survive, but there are also individuals whose quality of life or possibility for quality of life is so minimal that they also ought not to survive. And so immediately you're into questions of euthanasia. Some of you know the Living Will document put out by the American Euthanasia Society. You're into questions of fetal research, into questions of abortion, into questions of how to respond to the retarded. If life is to be defined in terms of quality, in terms of productivity, in terms of response, in terms of contribution to society, then there are all kinds of human beings that can be handled via lifeboat ethics. And John is going to move us from Hardin's lifeboat ethics position, which is global, into a more individual focus. And after that, we can have some conversation and we can work with it wherever you'd like. John?
If you can limit your focus, if you can limit your lifeboat size to just this country, and not the entire world, then if one thinks of our society as a lifeboat, those who live in society are equally susceptible to being pushed out of the lifeboat. Now, we all know that that's a fallacy. That's not true. In our society, we know that those who are most vulnerable are likely to be pushed out of the lifeboat, especially the handicapped. It's easy, if the handicapped are swimming toward the lifeboat or in the lifeboat, simply to take them and drop them out. They don't have the physical capabilities to fight for their existence in the lifeboat. They don't have the mental capacity to exert an influence to argue with those who would push them away. Fortunately, our society as yet, at this point, has not entirely built its lifeboat. At least I don't think so. I think that's very fortunate. We still have a little time. And so that's where the lifeboat analogy begins to break down to some extent. The slats, the seating capacity, the quality of the lifeboat itself is not fully formulated. Hence, as a society, we have a chance to decide what that lifeboat is going to look like and what it's going to hold. For the purpose of showing you the film today, I want to narrow your focus even a bit smaller. I want you to think of a hospital, Johns Hopkins Hospital, as the lifeboat. And in the film, you will see a child who's mentally retarded come into that lifeboat, and you'll see what happens in that lifeboat as a result of it. And the film speaks well for itself. There's no further need for introduction. If you'll just give me a chance to run upstairs to turn it on, I'll be right back.
The motion picture you're about to see could have been made in any hospital in the world, where agonizing decisions are faced by parents, by clergymen and doctors and lawyers every day. In this film, Johns Hopkins Hospital, one of the great medical centers of the world, was willing to present one such problem candidly. Breathtaking discoveries of modern medicine force new and torturous moral decisions upon us all. The Joseph E. Kennedy Jr. Foundation made this film to help us face up to those decisions with courage and knowledge and compassion while there is still time. Thank you.
The time, September 9, 1971. The people, Dr. Rene Fox, professor of sociology. Dr. William Curran, professor of legal medicine. Dr. Robert Cook, professor of pediatrics. Dr. John Fletcher, president of InterMed Seminary. Mrs. Sidney Callahan, psychologist and author. Few subjects are common to the professional lives of all these people. They are here to watch and discuss a film which deals with one of these, the subject of life itself.
Yeah.
Dad, what time is Mother awake? The doctor's up. I just say it looks a little mongoloid to me.
The diagnosis of mongolism can be made with a fair degree of certainty in the nursery. In addition to the mongolism, the patient had this disorder called duodenal atresia. There was no opening between the stomach and the lower intestine.
A child with duodenal atresia,
Dr. Haller knows a good deal about mongolism and has operated on many mongols with problems.
Doing fine. It's well hydrated. We have an IV and the NG tube is in.
So as far as you're concerned, we're all set to go in the morning.
Right.
There's some possibility that they are not going to want an operating procedure on that baby. She's a nurse and apparently has taken care of some children who were Mongols in the past and has some real serious reservations. But
the presence of a lesion that was incompatible with life allowed them to make the decision about whether they not only wanted their Mongol child, but whether they wanted their Mongol child to live or die. The child's life, if you look at a Mongol's life, was not one of pain, suffering, or misery, or that he would never learn, or that he would never know himself, or that he would never be an individual. His life, although certainly not normal, would be a life. I mean, he would be a living human being.
Making an opening so that the contents can go through all right. And so as you can see, it's a relatively simple operation, but it's in a fairly small baby.
Dr. Callaway wanted to operate on this patient. He did tell the parents, however, that it would be their decision.
But the operation will have no effect whatsoever on his underlying mongolism, because this is a condition which is separate from, although it may be related to, the abnormalities in his intestine. The mongolism condition is not going to be changed by fixing his intestinal structure.
From the parent's standpoint, they were looking forward to having this bouncing, happy, healthy baby, and then some physician tells them that their child is a Mongol. Why burden ourselves? Why burden society? Why burden everybody with this defective child? Why not simply let God's will be done?
Parents don't want any operating procedure to be done on the baby. And Dr. Haller has decided to respect their opinion and their belief about what they want done to the child. So we're going to stop any artificial means of prolonging the baby's life.
Several times he would call and say, how are things, meaning problem.
My
I felt uncomfortable talking to him, and I felt a little funny saying, well, things are working out, they're just taking a little slower. It took 15 days for the baby to become severely enough dehydrated that he finally died. That was an awful long time. That's my first reaction to seeing it. That's one of the toughest things I've ever seen people have to face. But film didn't tell you much about the kind of monolithism the baby had. But it's going to take me a minute or two.
I don't really understand why that would make any difference to me, what kind of monolithism he had.
What I'm aware of right now is two tremendous forces pulling against one another. One is that if a baby is born, you ought to do everything you can to preserve its life. That's what it seemed to me the doctor was reacting on. The other is a recognition of this, the severity of genetic diseases and respecting the power of that disease and wanting to act in the face of it, act responsibly as a parent, is the other thing. Yes, I would feel, to answer your question, I would feel less tense if I knew it was a very serious genetic disease.
What makes me angry? Here's a child who is as normal as any other baby almost, except it has a different future. It has a potential which is different, and somehow that changes the ball game completely. And it's very hard taking care of a baby like this, particularly when you see such a different outcome in so many instances. I've seen mongoloid children who have been a major source of comfort and pleasure of a family. In other words, been a destructive force in a family, and we've had a good deal of unhappiness as a result. But it seems so difficult to be able to predict what the situation is going to be at a time when you have a newborn baby. And in our society, awfully unwilling to seem to help us out of this kind of a jam.
But it's heartbreakingly moving to see this problem presented with a newborn child and presumably young parents, but it's not unique to this particular situation, the kind of problem with which the family on the one hand and the medical team on the other hand is faced. The physician has a very special kind of job to do, which involves, among other things, the ushering in of life and the ushering out of life.
Now that's a very neutral word, ushering out, as though this child had to die, and therefore he was just helping it, or he could have helped it along a little more in a sense. But that was a child that did not have to die. But what worries me is the fact that the parents were allowed to make this decision, as though that baby belonged to the parents. Now that, to me, is the key problem. Who do babies belong to? Do they belong to the parents? Does the parent have the right to say this baby will live or this baby will die?
Doesn't the way we live and grow up suggest that parents are responsible for decisions about procreation? In other words, nobody tells you how many babies you're going to have. They can do things to try to suggest to you how many babies, but finally, the decisions about procreation are up to the parents. Right? Now, this decision, the real question is whether this decision about the life or death of the baby should be in the hands of physicians. Who's going to make this decision? A lawyer? Are you going to bring in a moral counselor and put the weight on him? The parents did get stuck with that decision. I tend to feel that I could stand with the parents and live with them through that decision and support them. I would not want to come down real hard on them.
I have the feeling, with a very brief kind of glimpse of this family that we got, that these are relatively modestly endowed young couple who would not necessarily be able to move the world in order to provide this child with what it might need. Also, incidentally, we don't know whether they have other children and what the implications would be for the quality of life of those children. Dr. Cooker suggested it might very well be an enrichment in the family, but the cost
can be sometimes, but I guess what you're saying is that if you're poor, your retired children should die. If you've got adequate amount of money, why your retired kids can live. And I think that goes against my grain more than almost anything else, because I'm afraid this is the situation a little bit now, dramatized by this case, that there are big differences in this regard. And these seem to be pretty fundamental inequities. What bothers me most, I think, is basing all the decision on how defective an individual is going to be. Where do you draw the line at IQ 40, 50, 60, 70, 100? Because it's quite obvious that this child had duodenal atresia, obstruction of the intestine, and was not a mongoloid baby, then everyone would have operated. Parents would have been very grateful to the surgeon for saving the baby's life, or if the baby was not wanted by the family, why the courts would have intervened, I'm sure. And if you put all of the decision on the family, then the family can take this baby home without it. Let's say it's a mongoloid without duodenal atresia, not feed it. And I think that's certainly child abuse gets on the border of murder.
I suppose, like many of us, was most shocked that they left it as it was, that they, in a way, the medical people said this is up to the parents, which so often happens medically today. And there is a feeling that I think is a part of the culture that we've still got, that parents do make these decisions.
I'm very surprised when people say that the physicians are dumping this on the parent, because legally we don't have any choice. We can't operate on a baby without an op permit being signed, and it has to be signed by a parent, or else we're in for a healthy soup. One of the last cases was
not disturbed by the soup and you want to have the child. I mean, it seems to me you have to act under those kinds of circumstances.
Society, he's going to go against the courts, he's going to go against what the parents want.
A number of cases in which justice has been done, even against not just the the wish of these parents, which again we don't really quite understand, but they certainly didn't seem to identify with a religious belief or some other feeling against an operative procedure. They seem to have allowed the child to die merely because they did not want to bring it up.
If people can, you know, in a sense, harden the heart and not respond to the need of this child, I mean, this is something that I think happens all the way through our society. It's really destroying us, this ability to not feel, to flatten the emotions, to call it a technical name, or the patient is not going to have this operative procedure, and so that you can hide certain sort of elemental responses. And this man is emotional, and the tender animal, as well as the aggressive one, can have this tender, helping response. I would contend with Sydney, and I would say this to Dr. Cook too, that simply to, with great compassion and affect, give oneself monistically to the idea that this life must be saved, is to shut off a whole range of other, not just considerations, but feelings. This is a new young life. Our unequivocal responsibility is to use whatever we have available to us in modern medical science to preserve it, to save it. And there is no other consideration, there is no other right answer, there is no other suffering involved other than that a child's life should be snuffed out prematurely. And I would contend that this is an understandable, but nevertheless a defense mechanism that physicians use and gradually perfect, because they come up against so many times ancient problems like this, for which, as a matter of fact, there are no easy answers supplied, not only by the profession, but by the society at large.
The missing part of the film was that only the backs of parents' heads were shown. The problem is all the doctors. I want to tell you that parents agonize in the first 3 months of pregnancy about whether or not to have an abortion with a child that by definition would be terribly genetically deformed. Having an abortion doesn't remove the problem. So that the problems of the parents in making a decision whether to end the life of a child, not simple, even when it's after prenatal diagnosis and abortion, they suffer intensely, and they suffer for some time to come after the child is aborted. I personally don't think there is a lot of difference between the moral problems these parents face and the moral problem of ending the life of the child who's terribly deformed in the first couple or 3 months of pregnancy. The heart-wrenching part was sit and watch the child slowly die for 15 days.
When this baby's on our service, our staff was asking, not just do we operate on this baby, but if no one lets us operate, why can't we be given some permission from some authority to terminate this life more easily, to go on for 15 days torturing the nurses, the family, and so forth? Seems to be a terribly hypocritical. We condemn this baby to die the minute we agree not to operate. So if so, why do we prolong this tragedy for over 2 weeks?
I think there are many, many other situations like that to which the medical team almost stoically subjects itself without reflection. This physician, overburdened already by the moral nature of this decision, was also confronted with this.
I felt he made this man.
Yes,
he
did.
I don't know what you do. And there's something about that that cries out in him that I shouldn't have to bear all the responsibility for letting this child die, being stuck with it. Hence where what you say really comes through. He was being stuck with it.
Suppose the doctors had said, no, take the baby home. You start it at home if you're going to do this. Now, what would have happened?
I'm not sure that really we can put our feeling of, gee, isn't it a shame parents have to make the decision? Isn't it a shame that the medical people had to sit there and watch the baby die? I don't really think so. I think if they made that kind of decision, they ought to suffer through it. They ought to at least suffer through the anguish of what has happened. And say maybe even earlier, when the anguish would have been less, anguish will still be there.
What I feel that this case today is an example of a very primitive way of handling the problem.
But why are we, it seems to me we are so hypocritical. We stick a needle in the uterus at some risk to the mother, at some risk to the possibly normal baby, to make a diagnosis so we can end the pregnancy and not have an abnormal baby born. Well, if we are honest with ourselves, instead of the risk to the mother in the middle of her pregnancy, we ought to wait till the baby's born. There's no risk. He can do a blood test to determine whether or not he's a Lechnaian or a mongoloid baby or any one of the many defects with absolute certainty. And then you don't feed the infant. That's what we did in this case. We didn't feed this baby, nothing by mouth. So you let that baby die. Now somehow things are very different when the baby isn't born. So we go through a lot of maneuvers to avoid facing up to what happened in this case.
It seems to me that society continually is moving toward trying to make each individual's life an independent battle, and that at least at certain stages when people are helpless or people do not have an opportunity to exercise an independent judgment, we try to provide mechanisms to help them to do that. And it seems to me that here we've got to take our cases one at a time. We can't generalize everything. In this one individual case, I think a great wrong was done. I think much of what is going on in our society now, today, is that you do challenge. You do challenge it out front. You do challenge the right of the parent. You challenge each of these factors in the interest of what you feel to be the value of
the pendulum shifted in the other direction. We're getting hung up constantly on whether or not we've really informed people properly before we get their consent. I mean, the movement is all in the other direction. But the doctor now really doesn't even dare to take some blood from a patient without getting a permission from somebody, because the legal profession is breathing down our necks that we're doing things without informed consent.
In terms of colors, they're riding on the crest of changes that men are making in themselves. These are radical changes. Human beings are actually changing themselves. And that's what we've always done, only it's in the light of day. Everybody knows it. Our problem is how we're going to live with our power to change ourselves.
Spectrum from a specific baby in a hospital all the way to millions of people in whole nations, and the question is who shall survive? And the fact is that some decisions have to be made. So none of us knows the answer, but we can share with one another for some minutes and benefit from that sharing. So what would you like to say?
So you have to ask the right question first. If the question is solely, who shall survive? None of us are going to survive. I don't believe. I think the question is to be, who shall survive for how long? And I think the answer may change somewhat.
another thought comes to me, and that is we may struggle with these questions worldwide, but I wonder if we really have control of them. Not that we shouldn't be trying to do something. There are some things we can do. But in a total picture, what control or how much can we guide it?
Well, Garrett Hardin would say PL-480 was a disaster. It has only increased populations and increased the catastrophic proportions, inevitable catastrophic proportions. He would say that that legislation ought not to have been passed. He would say the World Food Bank is a disaster. He would say immigration procedures in this country are a disaster. It would seem to me that it's too easy to say we don't have control, because maybe we don't have total control, but we do vote, we do make decisions, and we have to worry about that, it seems to me. Maybe the control is only 2%, huh? But we do have some control.
It seems to me that the big problem with the lifeboat ethics image, and I absolutely agree that we need images to think about things. The problem is with these kinds of issues, it's that there are unprecedented situations coming before us that we can't talk about or even think about in the old ways. And so we devise images, and how many different metaphors have been used for the fetus? I don't think you can compare the fetus to anything. And it's a real problem here with this lifeboat ethics kind of thing. The problem is that in a lifeboat, you have a very limited kind of situation in which you can make certain calculations. You know exactly how many provisions you have, or how many people you have, and how long you can last, that sort of thing. But with, and even with the battlefield, you've got some kind of categories that you could devise, and you know how much you've got. But with the whole global situation, there are so many factors involved. Even with a single life, you cannot predict. And so it becomes ethically very dubious in making these kinds of decisions. It's just so difficult.
Okay, if you don't mind my pressing you a little bit to get the message, are you saying that because it is so incredibly complex and so incredibly difficult, we ought not to think about it. We ought not to reflect on our decisions. We ought to, I think the phrase was used in the film, let God's will happen, or so. You aren't saying that. You're simply pointing up the complexity.
I really think very simply that...
Do you either stand up or speak up? It's very hard to do this. There's no amplifiers.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I think it very simply because our nation is very blessed, that we have a responsibility to use those blessings. And if we have technology and if we are able to oversee world situations and make help to make some policies or to influence different international groups, then I think we should do it. But then, you know, there's the problem of the limitedness of our own perspective, too. I mean, why should we be the ones who decide, simply because we've been the ones with the military and economic power? So there's a real dilemma for me. I don't think we should stay out of it, but I'm not quite sure how we should be in it either.
Well, I think that the answer is out there someplace, and that the character of our faith goes in the direction of solving the problem. But what I hear in this dilemma is that it's not solvable. Maybe this is a part of the theology of glory, as Luther says, but why can't we try to pull it out of glory and put it on the ground? I don't buy the idea that it cannot be solved, but I don't have the answer. But I'm not going to tell myself that it cannot be solved.
One of the other aspects of the situation, as Jim and I have presented it to you, is that the Johns Hopkins situation has happened, is happening, whereas the future of the world as a lifeboat or a planet or spaceship is unknown.
Except that we have the Sahel and we have Bangladesh And we have, you know, two-thirds of the people in this world going to bed hungry every night tonight.
That's right.
As far as the lifeboat going under, maybe that's still future, although it has already gone under for millions of people, even in these last few years. So it isn't all that future, I think.
That's true. Again, in looking at this worldwide, and this relates to my first question, and that is, I think we do know some things that Bangladesh, these other countries, can do that would help them, and they won't do it. Now, this is part of this whole question. We want to help them, and they won't do the things that at least we feel would be part of the solution.
Now, Hardin is very clear on that. He says responsibilities must precede rights. He's got that all worked out. No responsibilities, no rights. So his answer would be, if you won't do what's necessary to do, cut off the aid. I'm not saying that. Hardin is saying that. But that's part of the issue, yes.
Yes, of course, but I recognize that the Caribbean analogy is too far from the breakdown. But one other thing about this lifeboat ethics, as we said, and I am with this fellow here, we're wondering, what are the alternatives? What about the competition? I guess competition is the proper way, concerning the grain. How much grain are being used to feed our cattle? And that grain could be used if we were to, put on our meat diet, as it were, and let some of the grain go to feed some of the hungry people. These are some of the questions and some of the alternatives I think have come before, particular, and if we look at America, we are in the lifeboat. No question about that. Alternatives, and I think one is for us as a people, and I'm talking individually and collectively, to start thinking in terms of our own lifestyle. And perhaps we don't have to have as much as we are consuming to live.
Because of that, I wonder, though, if we are the ones who will be able to make the decision that we should be in the lifeboat. Maybe the people who aren't in it should make the decision.
By climbing on, or by adopting certain responsibilities commensurate with rights, or I'm just wondering what direction your comment.
Well, I'm just wondering if we are capable of doing it. If we're so self-centered, so bound to our way, to being surviving for ourselves or our concern for others, it will enable us to, if that concern is deep enough, to enable us to make that kind of decision. Maybe we have to have a decision made by others.
Well, our commander-in-chief says we should love our neighbor as ourselves.
Yeah. Mary.
About the quality of the life in the lifeboat. You know, I mean, what kind of life is this, that this lifeboat is supposedly supporting? I mean, as he suggested, you know, does this mean that we're all, you know, we include our golf courses and our
homeless
villages and the gas to get up here and all that sort of stuff? Or is it a real survival?
Hardin is talking survival. He says, and I don't, I can't personally vouch for or not the statistics, but the growth rate, as I recall from his position in the United States, is 0.8%. It is, I think, in the two-thirds of the world, something like 3.3. You have the population in the United States doubling in 87 years. You have the population in the so-called third world population doubling every 21 years. You get, of course, the doubling of the doubling, and you get exponential growth. And you project that, the trajectory of that kind of population growth, into the year even 2000, And you've got a case, Hardin would say, of survival. So that you can take all the fertilizer from all the golf courses all over the world, and you're going to produce, Hardin says, what he calls the ratchet effect. That is, there's a prowl there, whatever you call it, that catches the ratchet for a while. It simply increases the monstrous size of the inevitable catastrophe. All I'm doing at the moment is trying, you know, is to present that position. We have spent most of our time on the global thing, the way it's gone. We still have the baby at Johns Hopkins. We still have medical teams making decisions about who's going to be put on that kidney machine, who's going to be put on that heart-lung machine. Decisions made every day, and everybody cannot survive. Huh? Everybody cannot survive, and somebody makes those choices. On what basis? The same thing occurs, of course, at the other end of the spectrum, where one has to ask, or people have to ask, shall this life be preserved by heroic measures? And so the whole death with dignity thing gets talked about. And it's the same question on the other end of the spectrum. We'll take one more comment, or let's take two more comments, and then we have to be responsible, I think, about the lunch bell. We'll take this one and then back there.
Just a brief question here. Many of these decisions, it seems to me, can fall into two categories, either the what I might call emotional or objective. Is there a place in ethical consideration for objective solutions or objective answers to questions of this type?
Quick response, not answer, as far as I'm concerned, yes. No database, no sanity. Huh? Yeah, so if we make decisions only on the basis of emotions, you know, we're sunk.
But
that's just a response. Yeah, but there's a spectrum again. Huh? It's always a mix.
Again, this is an authority above a state authority, and it doesn't
Okay. Hopefully the issue has been raised, and we can think about that, not simply as human beings, but as Christians. And it's going to take a lot of conversation with one another to arrive at anything remotely related to a responsible decision or posture. Thank you.